Into Luke's gospel. Now, this is where we've been. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. This is the moment. We're coming to the end of the chapter 23. The three ministries that Jesus would fulfill, which no other human being, even under the law, couldn't fulfill. Prophet, priest, and then ultimately king. Those three roles, as far as any other human being is concerned, were never to be mixed. That was the law. Jesus is the only one that can fulfill those. And we've been looking at this now. We've been in Luke probably for the better part of 2 years. Because as everyone knows, I move rather rapidly, quickly through things. But I hope that you understand the significance of what we've been understanding as Luke focuses on Christ as the Redeemer. You know, as I was popped into my mind there as I was praying this movie. These are wonderful things to see that. But I hope that people aren't going to just see a movie, to see a script. I hope that they go there to see a Savior. Because even though this is media driven, which is a good thing, I'm not in any way putting that down. By all means, use media to advance the gospel. But I pray that what they don't see there is a movie, but they find the Messiah. Because that's what this is all about. It's rather pointless if that isn't the case. And so I hope you keep that in mind as you go into this movie, that is as cool as it's going to be, that you take to heart what's going on. And we've been looking at that, his ministry as prophet. You'll see that in the movie. I don't know for sure, but I'm assuming she's basing it on Luke, Roma, and the other, I can't remember the dude's name, just draw a blank. But anyway, that they're focused on the gospel, Luke's gospel. And the reasons why we've been studying Luke's gospel, because it's so pointed there. It's not that the other gospels don't have their value, but Luke is that special thing that really just has that, speaks to us as human beings, the Son of Man. I mean, what else can you talk about? So in the movie, pay attention to that as his whole first part of his ministry was that of proclamation, that of proclaiming the truth, prophet, the work of a prophet, and then moves into the what we call the Passion Week, which is literally the last 7 days of his life, which we've been studying. The 7 days of his life have now taken us about 8 months to take a look at, but you get the idea. And then we'll move when we come to the conclusion of chapter 23, because that's when he will be find himself in the tomb. But starting in chapter 24, he'll fulfill that final role, that of king, because it's only the king that can overcome death, the greatest enemy man has ever known. And this is one of the things that I shared, and I know and want to thank you guys before I go any further for your prayers for my family last week. We weren't here. I know that many of you know that. We were down south in San Diego. And I must say, while you guys were sitting here in the church, we were on the beach. But it's not my fault that they did the funeral on the beach. I didn't pick it, but it was awesome. It was beautiful, just like this. I couldn't believe it. It's amazing. Anyway, we had a great service, and it was a great time. But one of the things I share with these people is that, you know, it's amazing how in this life, even as believers, we'll spend so much time trying to gather things to us that we can never last, things that we can never hold on to, when we should be instead focusing on the things, you know, as Jesus taught us himself, set your mind on things above, not on things of the earth, and yet we just find ourselves completely horizontally focused. So I always share that, you know, that's one of the things that we need to understand, is that the only certainty in this life, and I mean the only certainty, and it isn't just taxes, it's death. Every person in this room, unless the Lord returns, every person in this room will face that ultimate step. And we'll spend all of our time and all of our efforts gathering all of this stuff without ever stopping to think about that. And for my cousin at 42, was his call to go home. Something we would never think. And then, and just the, I know that many of you have, you know, others that have, you know, gone through this thing at much younger ages, but that eternally. Well, that's why we're studying this. That's why we're taking a look at Luke, to understand that the course that Jesus set for us was not just a course to be followed in this life, but in the life to come. Because he would be king and he would overcome death. And by what he has done for us, we then can have that hope that this is not all there is. Thank God this isn't all there is, huh? Holy cow. If this is all there is, things ain't getting better for me. I don't know about you. Right? I about passed out trying to suck in my belly this morning. Snapped the top button of my jeans here. And this is not good. Things are not good here on this side of the things. I want to look forward to the day when I can just slip right into those old 38s because I refuse to go to a 40. I'm not going to do it. So instead, I'll stand here until my earlobes swell up. But anyway, Things are not getting better here. Why do we focus on it? No matter what we gain in this life, it is never enough. It's never going to be enough. So as we look at these last few moments of Jesus and as we move forward to this devastating day, on one hand, because of sin, but on the other hand, the greatest day in the history, even before the creation, that's the day. And so we've been moving slowly through this now, and we've been looking at this, and we saw it started earlier when Jesus entered into the city of Jerusalem for that final week, Passion Week, we call it, the great triumphal entry, when he presented himself at the temple as the lamb to be sacrificed. We talked about how they completely missed it because they were about their own business, gathering their own things. Sound familiar? And they missed the fact that the Messiah had showed up. And then how he went through the week, and we've been looking at a day-to-day, almost moment by moment, at least for that which is recorded during those periods of time. And as we come now, we come to when we concluded a couple of weeks ago, we saw that he is now he's now carrying his cross, the instrument of his own execution. And he's carrying it from the presence of all of those who hate him, from their presence out to this place where this is going to get even worse. And so we looked at that and how we said that when he carried the cross, that he certainly did that. That remember, you must keep in mind, they didn't carry the cross. They only carried the cross beam. It's impossible for a human being to carry a cross that would bear their weight. You just simply couldn't do it. It's too much. So even for the most hardened of criminals, you only had to carry the cross piece, the piece that went across the top. That's what you had to carry. But that in and of itself was probably what we would call a 12 by 12. So a big honking piece of wood that was very heavy. And we know that Jesus was unable to bear it. And so they called up Simon, the Cyrenian, a fellow from Cyrene who had just showed up to be there for the Passover, and they brought him in, and we looked at how as Jesus begins to weaken under the weight of this cross, that they call on Simon and they bring him forward, and we talked about how the words are written in such a way in the original language, not so much in our English, that Jesus took the place behind him. So in other words, he carried the back half of that beam while Jesus carried the front, and they went to Golgotha, and that's where we left the story of last time. But there's one other thing I want to point out. Remember that as all this was taking place, it was the women. It was the women that had surrounded him with broken hearts and confused minds. And they wept. And the word, I think we talked about this, I don't remember if I nailed this down or not, but the idea of weeping, there is weeping to the point where you can't even catch your breath. So in other words, sobbing. And then Jesus sees this. And in the midst of his struggle, he says to these women, "Don't weep for me. It is not me you have to weep for. It is you. Weep for yourselves. Because the days are coming," said, when everything that you think and everything that you hold dearly is going to be ripped away from you. And that, in fact, would happen just about 40 years, probably a little less than 40 years after he made those statements, because Rome would come in and would level the city and leave only a portion of one wall, which we know today as the Wailing Wall. 2,000 years, that thing has been leveled there. And Jesus had warned those ladies. And then we saw that he went on, and we know that there were a couple of criminals. Probably the third cross that Jesus was himself carrying was supposed to have been carried by one Barabbas. Barabbas, son of the father, who was a criminal. He was a thief. He was a murderer. And yet he was set free so that Christ could carry the cross. And we talked about when we looked at his life how that's just like me. I know exactly what Barabbas felt. I hope I responded differently than he did, as far as we know. But that's what's taken place to lead us to this point. Okay? Now, when we jump into this, we're going to actually get now to the moment of the cross. Now, I have to tell you, and I think I've mentioned this before, I'm thrilled that this movie is coming out. I really am. But I'll tell you, if you will honestly take the time to get into these passages on your own and take them apart. I mean, really take them apart. Ask all of the question, what's going on here? What was this like? What was the emotions that were involved in this? All of these things, you'll get a much different picture. And the agony and the suffering that this one who was so innocent and completely undeserving of all of this treatment, this brutality that had been heaped upon him, the false accusations, the downright lies, the hypocrisy, the mocking, the jeering, the spitting, his beard being plucked out, the thing being beat down on his head. When you really stop and think that, instead of just reading it through like we so are accustomed to do, I'll tell you something. If that doesn't get you in the heart, you have a serious problem. Because as I study this stuff and I look at this, I'm constantly sitting back just going, God, why would you do this for me? Because you have to remember, for me, and I hope for you as well, when I read that story, I'm the only one in the crowd there. Because I know that what he did there was because of me. And I hope you understand that too. If you don't, you need to take that into consideration. And the thought that I'm standing amongst all of these people, and we're going to see that again, I don't know if we'll get it to this week, but in this account that we're talking about here, that I'm just one of the crowd. And I'm heartbroken by what's happening. And I cannot come to terms with why he would do this for me when he knows me. He knows what's in here. He knows what's in here. None of you do. Not even my wife knows what's really in here on the deepest level. But he does. And with that mindset, I'm studying these stuff and I'm looking at this and I find myself just going, why? Why would you do this when you know how I am? How do you come to terms with something like that? And it's just very, very difficult. So as we read these words, what we're going to see is there's all sorts of different players in this episode. And there always is, but we're going to really focus on those. Because each of us is in one of those positions. Okay? We're going to see everything from the crowds. Certainly Jesus, he's the key figure. That's obvious. You're going to see that there are the crowds. You're going to see that there are those of the council, in other words, the critics of who Jesus was, the ones that hated him and were just trying to get rid of him. We're going to see the Romans and their callous attitude towards all of these things because it was just old hat. We're even going to see the believers and what happened to them. Those that swore that they would follow him to the end, much like you and I. And last but not least, we're going to see that there's a couple of guys who are unnamed, and one of them we'll get to talk to when we get to heaven, because they're called the two thieves, criminals, probably the partners of Barabbas. They're two-thirds of what was supposed to be crucified that day until Jesus sacrificed himself on behalf of one of those individuals. Two of them would receive eternal life. One of them would not, by his own choice. So as we look at this encounter, pay attention to that. And it's nice to say, well, I would have been with the believers. Well, let me tell you, when we get to that point, I'm not sure we'll get to it this morning. That's not a good thing. Because we're going to see that they ultimately were nowhere to be found. They were off at a distance, Luke says. So that's not a great place to be. Instead of being right there and being a part of everything that was going on. So before we think, oh, well, I know where I'd have been. I would have been with the believers. Well, stop and think about what that means. But the reality of it is we've all at different times in our life been in each one of those positions. Knowing full well that Jesus made this journey, but never or at least seldom paying heed to what that meant. Okay? So keep that in mind as we move through. There's a great way to start the message out, huh? Bum everyone out first. But it's okay. Isn't it cool that God knows that? Because when I get those feelings and stuff and I just say, Lord, why? Why would you do this? And you know what he says to me, that still small voice? Because I love you. To which my reply is, but how? He says, you don't need to understand that. Just believe it. And that's what gets you through. So let's go and start on this. Now, and when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him and the criminals. That is the two thieves, obviously. And one was on the right and the other was on the left. Now, what I want to do as we move through this, and this is why these few short verses in Luke are probably going to take us a few weeks. Gee, imagine that. Because I want to weave in Matthew and Mark. Because as we've said so many times, and we'll even get into John, that this encounter, they were all there observing this, except possibly Luke. But Luke had gotten firsthand accounts. We know that from the beginning of the letter. But these guys were all eyewitnesses of this. And the reason that's significant is because just like today, each person, quote unquote, eyewitness, sees the same exact thing, but identifies different aspects of it. No two people are going to see the same thing and agree on exactly what the meaning of that is. This is why it frustrates me to no end that the Bible critics say, oh, the gospel writers didn't even agree. It's like, really, dude? And who would agree with you? I mean, stop and think about it. What a dumb thing to say. To criticize because there's four different perspectives, four unique perspectives of a same event, proves nothing except that we're human beings. We all see things differently. That's just the way it is. And what was important to Matthew and stood out to Matthew may not have been as important to Mark and stood out to Mark. But what was important to Mark, he put in there. And John, and when Luke was gathering all of this information and writing this stuff down, he picked those places that, even though he may not have been there, that he understood was so significant to him, and that's what he put down. So I don't understand what the big to-do is about all of this. What a dumb thing to say. And yet people go, oh, yeah, that's why I don't go to the Bible. Even the gospel writers couldn't. And you know where they get that from? Because they listen to the critic yo-yo say that, and they think he's all right without ever stopping to think it through. Because we, mankind, is exactly as Jesus identified us, sheep without a shepherd. We don't have a clue where we're going. We're just wandering around aimlessly. And so if anybody voices something that sort of rings in our ear a little bit, we'll tend to lean towards that. Oh yeah, I believe this. And we have the same thing with the science concept. We literally believe people that say science and faith don't mix. Bunky, hunky. There you go. Oh, crud, I just got to stop and thinking about that. You don't know, we're doing our test run tonight and actually doing audio visual. So hopefully this is a test run and that won't make it onto the website. But that's a bunch of malarkey. Science and faith have no problems. In fact, science proves the Bible. Now, you're never going to hear that, but that's exactly accurate. Because what science continues to prove, whether they'll admit it or not, is that the scripture is absolutely accurate. Over and over and over again. So this concept, but people all over this world will deny Christianity because they'll stand on the side of science because they're convinced, because someone told them, that you couldn't have both. Don't tell that to the guys at Institute for Creation Research. Don't tell that to Dr. Tom. You know, Tom Kindle that came and taught us about that stuff. By the way, I talked with Tom. We got him coming back in May. He's going to be here on a Sunday in May on the 18th. He's going to do a morning service and an evening service. And if you have not seen this stuff, because he's a scientist, a creation scientist, you can't have both. Yes, you can. He's proof. You need to hear this stuff. Because all this crud that's being taught to our kids, it's just that crud. And it's really interesting to get these perspectives. So as we move through this, we're going to interweave these things because of these, you know, the different positions. And we need to understand these guys because there's a reason God put them in His Word. Okay? So we're going to weave these back and forth. So this is Luke's account of that. So when they had come to the place called Calvary, he leaves it there. And by the way, the word Calvary in the Greek language, which is of course what Paul would have written, is cranium. Does that sound familiar for anyone with a medical background? What is the head called? Cranium. The skull. Yeah. That's what it is. That's the word. So whenever you say Calvary, the word Calvary in the English, Calvary Chapel, we're now called Skull Chapel. So we could put the skull and the crossbones out there and draw all sorts of people in. Right? But that's what the word literally means. Cranium. We get cranium from it. It means head or skull. Isn't that interesting? So when they had come to the place called Skull, there they crucified him. And the criminals, one on the right and one on the left. Now before we jump into the other passages, I find that interesting. Did you catch it? One on the right and one on the left. In other words, Jesus is the center. Now, for us as believers, that's as it should be. I mean, he is obviously the most significant human being in this world because he's more than a human being. He is God. But that makes all the sense of the world to us. But stop and think about what's going on here. This is the Jewish religious leadership the multitude of crowds that are following, his own believers and Rome, let alone these criminals, and they put him in the middle. Now think about that for a second. Why would they do that? Why? Could be because he was carrying, as I said earlier, maybe he was carrying the burden that was to be placed on Barnabas, or I'm sorry, Barabbas. That could be it, and maybe he was the worst of the three, and so he was going to get the middle slot. But good grief, you'd think that since he was no longer the one guilty, and this man whose only accusation was that he claimed to be the king of the Jews, for goodness sake. In fact, we're going to see that that was the thing that was put above his head for the charges that were brought against him. The other two would have had murderer, criminal, thief, you know, instigator, rebel, you know, whatever, rebel. You just go on and on and on. And yet we find him right in the middle. And I find that very intriguing. I don't know the answer to it. I really don't. Except I'm sure that he was orchestrating the whole thing. But see what I mean when you stop and you really think through that? Why on earth would Rome, because that's who ultimately is in control of a crucifixion. Now, they're not in control of this crucifixion because Jesus is in control, even though it doesn't look like it. But as far as Rome is concerned, why on earth would they put him in the middle? Why would they do that? I mean, noodle that through for a while. That's really interesting because it seems abnormal. I mean, he had the least of the charges. Why put him in the middle? Maybe just for that reason. Who knows? I don't know the answer to that, but that's what I'm talking about. When you read and you take your time to work slowly through these things, it's these little things that cause you to stumble. Now, I'm grateful he was in the middle because of what it means to me as a person. But from a pure historical event, there's something really going on here. Wish I could give you the answer. I don't know, but hopefully I got you thinking about it. Now here's Matthew. We're going to spend most of the stuff between Matthew and John and Luke. That's basically the same thing, but again, Matthew is a Jew. Luke is not. So Matthew's going to give us a little more insight than Luke would, as you could imagine, because Matthew was from that area. He was, as I said, a Jew. This was his land. Luke isn't. We believe him to be a leader within, or a person of power and authority or whatever amongst the Romans. And so you wouldn't expect him to say these kinds of things. But here's what Matthew says, almost the same, but then he adds some. And when they had come to the place called Golgotha, now what he does is he throws out a term here, which is Aramaic, all right? Because in those days, that was the language that they spoke, as well as Greek, Latin, as well as Hebrew. They were multilingual, okay? Now, as Americans, well, we're starting to see that obviously more now, but this is the way it's always been in the world. When we were in Belize, the people that we worked with down there were truly amazing. I mean, these people could be talking to you and turn around and talk to somebody, one of the other Maya people in Kekchi, and they could start speaking Kekchi and then turn this way and start speaking Spanish to Juan, and then turn around and talk English to me. And then somebody, one of the Creole people, would walk by speaking Creole, and they'd switch. I mean, these people just went from one language to another. It was absolutely amazing. Marie and I talked about it the whole time we were there. It was just phenomenal how easy they flowed from one language to the other. So this is very common in the world. We don't so much have it that much here, although we're starting to get it. See, but that's what was going on here. So he's using an Aramaic term. Now what you need to understand, and I don't have time to really develop all of this, but if you're here on Wednesday nights, we're doing the Table of Nations right now. And what we're looking at is the idea that when God dispersed people and gave them each the languages, there were those languages that are related. Now the linguists will tell you this. They're all can be traced back to a common source. That source would be called Hebrew. Imagine that. Okay? Aramaic was one that's closest. In fact, they're so almost interchangeable, you can't tell. Even the way they write the letters and stuff, and going from, well, for you guys, it'd be this way, right to left, instead of left to right like we do. And so he uses a word here, the Golgotha, and it means the same thing, skull. Okay? And then he translates, that is to say, the place of the skull. That's what it is. Now, what he adds to this, Luke actually tells us about another encounter, but I think it's different. Some say it's the same, but I don't believe it's the same. Here they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. Now this is, they're preparing to crucify him. In other words, they're getting ready to lay him down to nail his hands to the crossbeam, then lift him up there and then nail his feet to the post. Okay? That's where we're at. They've just put the beam down, they're going to lay him down, and that's what's going on. But before they did that, one of the things that they would do was they would give the people that were about to undergo this excruciating pain, and by the way, did you know that the word excruciating, which is pain beyond comprehension, excruciating, crucifixion. That's where the word comes from. So this intense pain that no human being could, they had this sort of mixture of, you can see there, basically we would call it vinegar. That's what it amounts to, with some other stuff added to it. And they would give this to these guys to sort of numb their senses. Okay? If you saw Braveheart, which Marie and I just watched, she watched most of it, I just saw the end of it. But when before he's going, the lady tries to give him this stuff to help him, but he doesn't take it, he spits it out, he fakes her out. Man, that Mel Gibson, he's quite the guy, huh? I was trying to figure out how he kept that stuff in his mouth while he did a lip lock with her, though. I was confused by that. Anyways, in other words, why wouldn't she get anesthetized by the same thing? But anyway, but that's what they're doing. They're trying to give him an anesthesia to calm the pain, and this is why he doesn't receive it. Because he understands the cost of sin, and he has to bear the full weight. He understands that. And that's what Matthew was adding on here. Now, the significance of this is Matthew, as a Jew, is writing to Jews. Matthew's gospel is written to the Jews. And Matthew was constantly referring back to the Old Testament because he wants his readers to understand that Jesus is the fulfillment of everything the Old Testament had written. So Matthew's has the greatest number of references back to the Old Testament for that very reason, as a Jew. Mark wrote to Romans, Luke wrote to all nations, not just the Romans or the Greeks. And then, of course, John wrote to the Greeks in particular. And so each of these had a different audience, and so they focused on different things. But this is really significant because of what's taken place here. Because both of these guys, and Mark is very close to the Matthew account, and what they're ultimately saying is that when it came time for this to happen, and Jesus knowing that now the physical aspect of this, not that he hadn't already suffered physically, but now the physical suffering was about to be intensified by about a million times, that there was a way out. In other words, or at least a way to make it easier, and he wouldn't take that route. Isn't it nice to know that he didn't take the easy road? You see, this is another thing that separates him from you and I, because we will always take the easy road, always. Because we're human beings, we're just prone to take the path of least resistance. It just comes by nature to us. That's what we always do. Now, there are times when we will stand against the flow, but for the most part, this is what's going on. But that's why this is so significant. Because he knew if he was going to bring redemption, which of course was what this is all about, and restore or make it possible to restore the relationship that you and I can have with God because it had been broken by sin, if he was going to do that, he had to do this completely and fully aware of everything that was going on, so he wasn't going to take the chance. Now, we're not told, but there's no doubt that the other two fellows probably took part of this, all right? And then it goes on to say this, incredible verse. Only Luke records this statement. I find that really interesting. Because again, remember, Luke wasn't there, right? Matthew and Mark and John were. And yet it's Luke that records the first statement of Jesus, because there are seven of them while he's on the cross. In fact, for Easter, I'm thinking, if I was going to say we'll be done with this by the time Easter gets, but that's probably not going to happen. But I just think it's really interesting, because if you're Matthew, Mark, or John, and you know the role you played in that day, this would be a tough thing for you to write about, but not Luke. And he's this amazing statement. Then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do." Father, forgive them. Who's them? Everyone. Everyone that's involved in this. Knowing where the crowd stood, knowing where the council of the religious stood, knowing where the calloused Roman soldiers stood, knowing where the criminals were, knowing where the Christians were. Knowing all of that. Father, forgive them, because all of us had a role to play in that, regardless of what position we find ourselves in on that day. Now, as you read through this, and if you do it carefully, and you look at it in light of the other Gospels, this statement appears, and I can only say appears because we don't know, we're not told, but it appears to me that he makes this statement just prior to the when they would drive the nails into his arms on the crossbeam on the ground. And then they would pick that up, the Romans, and they'd clunk it into the post. Now, why is that significant? Because I think, as I pointed out a few weeks back, that when Jesus was arrested in the garden, that he made that statement. Remember, he said, "This is your hour." In other words, the enemy's. This is your hour, but it's an hour of darkness. And we've been pointing out that just happened just a few hours ago. Remember, we're only a few hours removed from that at this juncture. So darkness appears to still be in control. Now, I pointed out at that time how it's not just physical darkness that he's talking about. There's obviously spiritual darkness as well, the hour of darkness. And I pointed out at that time how to the unseen, or to the eye that cannot see, in other words, ours, cannot view the spiritual realm, there was a ton of things going on within the spiritual. Because Jesus would later, right after that statement, tell Pilate that, listen, if I chose to, I could simply speak and there would be 12 legions of angels, 72,000 angels that would show up immediately if I called. Because Jesus understood the spiritual side. Now, we're not told this, but we know this is what's going on because of what the writers would tell us later throughout the New Testament. So there's this whole thing that's going on here beyond the physical. There's this spiritual thing. Now, let's assume that those 72,000 angels had left from Pilate's and Herod's and are now standing on one side of Jesus as this is taking place to him, while the host of demonic activity, spiritual darkness, is standing opposed. But remember, spiritual darkness with Lucifer at the head of this, at this juncture, they're absolutely certain they've won. Because they're watching the seed, the promised seed of Genesis chapter 3. They're watching his demise. So they thought. At this point, they believe that. So there's this whole deal that's going on. And you can see Michael, and you can see Gabriel, both having to do with Israel. Gabriel in particular, as the messianic angel. And you can see them, if you try hard enough, looking across this event at those other guys. And the reason that's significant is because if Jesus doesn't say, "Father, forgive them," can you imagine what would have taken place? It's those words that would have held them at bay. And we don't know, because he did make this statement, we don't know what could have happened. But isn't it a possibility that at this point that God in heaven would have said, "That's enough. This will go no further," and simply, and everybody's toast. We just don't know. But this statement of Jesus stays the hand of everything that is around. Certainly in the spiritual, which we've been talking about. But stop and think about something now. Let's go back to the physical, because that's the realm we are familiar with. As this is going on, imagine if you're these Roman soldiers, if you're the religious haters, if you're the criminals at his side, if you're the crowd watching this, and in the midst of all this, the words out of this man's mouth are not, "I am innocent, this is a travesty, you know, God's wrath be upon you." Those are the words you would expect. "Please no, don't do this," whatever. I would have been sniveling and whining, no doubt about it. But the first words out of his mouth that everybody, not only in the spiritual, but in the physical, would have heard, "Father," first, "Pater," "Father, forgive." You got to wonder if, as the guy, the soldier's bringing down the hammer, and all of a sudden he goes, "What did he just say?" He's asking for forgiveness, not for himself, but for all of us. Can you imagine what that must have been like? You do know what it's like. Because all of us, at one point in our lives, before we become a follower of Christ, we're that soldier. "Oh no, I would never have done it." Yes, you did. You drove those spikes into him, just like the Roman soldier did. By the way that you lived, the things that you did, the things that you said, we all drove the spikes in there, let's be honest. All of us. And sadly, sometimes still do. But imagine that. And remember, when you were doing that, that all of a sudden the voices heard, Father, forgive. This is the part I grapple with. How could God forgive me knowing I'm the one driving the dang nails? I'm later going to be the one that stabs him. I've already driven the thorns onto his head and spit in his face by the way that I lived my life. So you see, there's a lot in this one statement. And we can go on and on and on. But I think you get the idea. Father, forgive them. They have no clue what they're doing. They think they understand. Isn't it sad how we live our lives always thinking that we get it, when the reality is we don't have a clue? We talk about eternity, we talk about spiritual things as if they're a reality, and then live as though those things mean nothing to us at all. They don't know what they're doing. Boy, if that first statement didn't cause that guy to pause as he was bringing down that hammer on those spikes, you and I, that certainly would. They don't know what they're doing. All of a sudden, can you imagine what that must have felt like? And the people standing back, watching all of this and going, what? He's saying we don't understand. All of a sudden, you're thinking within yourself, is there more to what's happening here than the normal crucifixion, which we go watch every Saturday with the kids? You know, I mean, that was the entertainment. Sad to say, but that's what they did, just like they did with the gladiators and all of that stuff. Oh, man is inherently good, they tell us. Really? Then how can an inherently good human being take their children to watch people slaughter one another? Inherently good? Really? What have you been smoking? For anybody to make that statement is absolute absurdity. And yet this is what, again, we're told by those that have all the things hanging on the walls. Really? These people love the blood and the gore and the guts and stuff like that because it was happening to someone else. Man is inherently good, then how can he slaughter 6 million people? And before Hitler, Titus and the Roman armies, in fact, that 40 years we talked about earlier that's going to come on these guys, Josephus tells us that when they went in and leveled the city, they killed around 2 million Jews. And all of us forget, we remember that. We remember the invasion and the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, as I said, evidenced by the Wailing Wall, the only thing left of it. We remember that, even though we don't pay a lot of attention to it. We certainly remember the Holocaust. And we forget about the millions, probably more than even in the Holocaust, that were slaughtered by the Russians during the pogroms. Over and over again. How do those atrocities happen? How do children starve in places that you and I see pictures of all the time if man is inherently good? What a contradiction in terms. And yet we're led to believe that this is the reality. I'm telling you, these people are high. You have to be to come to a conclusion like that. This is a dumb thing to say. So Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do. That had to absolutely stop every heart that was in hearing distance of what was going on here. Because they would have immediately identified, this is not normal. Something bigger than what we're seeing is taking place here. And certainly it was. We know the end of the story, don't we? They didn't. We've had a couple of thousand years to have this completed and all the books written about it since that time. We have all that benefit, but those folks didn't. They had the Old Testament prophets, at least for the Jews, that had spoken to this. But in their minds, they hadn't seen it come to fruition like it was happening right in front of them. I mean, think about that. It's so easy to be calloused like the Romans and point fingers at the people of the day. How could they? How could they? Because they didn't have the benefit of history that you and I have. They didn't even have the Spirit living inside of men. And yet we want to condemn them, don't we? Yes, we do. One of the reasons Hitler slaughtered the Jews was because they were Christ killers. See? I mean, we could just go on and on, but you get the idea. And then they divided his garment and they cast lots. Now, what you need to understand And I don't, nobody wants to think about this. We always see, you know, these incredible pictures and depictions of the cross with the Lord on the cross. And though it looks, you know, bad, you know, I mean, really? Does it look that bad? Not so much. He's always got the little towel wrapped around his loins. And we think, oh, that must have been terrible. That is not what they did. They stripped you naked. You hung naked for the world to see. Humility. They wanted to mock you. They wanted to ridicule you. They wanted to expose you. There was no covering of certain parts of the body so that the person wouldn't feel shamed. Are you kidding me? The whole intention of the cross was to cause people to stop and think before they did anything against Rome. To remove your very dignity from you when you could do nothing about it. Hung completely exposed before the world with your crime hung above your head. So this little picture of him laying there with his little towel wrapped around him is pathetic. This was brutality at its worst. Remember that the next time you look on a cross. And this is why it's an offense to some, which Paul said. Paul taught us. It's nothing new, you know, that the cross is an offense. Why is it an offense? Because it's a cross? No, because of what it represented. So this is what's happening. So when they took his garments off, we always see the pretty pictures in the movies, right? We have to stop thinking like that. You want to know, go back and study this. This form of execution, to this day, I don't know if you guys are aware of this or not, man has never, ever, throughout its history, devised a more terrible way for a human being to die than crucifixion. Nothing comes close because of what its intent was. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. I know many of us have read that what a person ultimately died of was drowning because they were hanging and all the stuff that was going on, the lungs would ultimately fill with water, which is why when they stuck the spear in Jesus' side, water came out. Edema, it was collecting in there. They would find it hard to breathe. And nobody tells you about while all those wounds were exposed and your chest and everything was, you know, was exposed, and there was the blood and there was the flesh hanging off there. Nobody tells you about the stories of the birds that would come and peck the eyes out of the guy hanging on the cross. Or the carrion birds that would come and tear at the flesh while the person hung on the cross. No one tells you about that. But that's the reality of it. And as it would get worse and worse, the person would try to lift themselves to breathe. And that's why they did the nail in the feet, to extend the torture. Because if you can't breathe, you can't last. They wanted you to last. So in spite of the pain, breath is more important. So you would lift yourself to be able to catch your breath so your diaphragm could relax instead of being completed down by hanging like this. And after a while, you couldn't support your own weight. That's the reason they did these things. So when they divided his garments and they cast lots, keep that in mind the next time you read those words. What was going on here? We always see the pretty robe. We even had a movie about it back in the 60s when the robe came out. Great movie now, I'm not knocking it. But it always takes that side, you know, you just can't see what really was taking place there. That's why I wanted to take the time to tell you. Because it was disgusting. And yet here were the crowds watching it. Because man is inherently good. Well, here's what Matthew says. And then they crucified him. That means they drove his nails into his arms, getting ready to put him up. And they divided his garments and casting lots. Well, we've already read that. But here's what Matthew adds. That it might be fulfilled, which was written by the prophets. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. That's right directly out of the Psalms, chapter 22. They didn't have chapters and verses in those days, but they would have known exactly where this was. Now, how you could be a religious leader who claims to be an expert in the law and the Torah and the Old Testament and not see what's happening in front of you and go, wow, you know what? We're watching Scripture being fulfilled here. But you see, they were so blinded by their hatred of him that they weren't able to see the truth and the reality of what was going on. So Matthew, because he's writing to Jews again, remember, Old Testament, he brings the Old Testament in, making sure that people understand. Psalm 22 is a messianic psalm. Later, it will be the very psalm where Jesus will utter his last, well, not his last words, but almost his last words. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, from the cross. It's also Psalm 22. We're going to get to that when we get there, so I don't want to take time. Now notice this. All of this is going on. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Look at verse 36. Sitting down, they kept watch over him. Simple verse, simple words. Do you see what's happening? This is unbelievable. Matthew tells us that after all of this was taking place, that they, probably the Roman soldiers, but beyond that, they sat down and just watched to see. What were they watching? What were they watching? To see if he was who he claimed to be? To enjoy the spectacle that they had been right and he was nothing more than a charlatan and deserved the death like the criminals on the side of him? Who knows? Who knows? But sitting down. Well, we'll just sit back and watch the show. Yeah, it disgusts me a little bit, but you know, what the heck? Got nothing else to do. You know. Church prayer is until 5. Yeah. Sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Oof. Oof, oof, oof. Boy, we could go off with that. Now, verse 35, Luke gives us, puts everybody in the same sentence. Because again, Luke has a different perspective. What he just wants to know is that there were people mocking. And this is what Luke says, and the people stood looking on. So there were some sitting, obviously there were some standing. But even the rulers with them sneered, saying, he saved others, let him save himself if he is the Christ, chosen of God. As if it wasn't enough, what he was going through, the insults, again, the mockery, the indignity, the inhumane treatment that was being expressed to you would think that it would have been enough to just say, you know what, it's over now, just let the man go. But oh, no, no, get it in there, drive it in. Because after all, he's out of the way now, so we have to reestablish ourselves with the people. They were following him. Now, the movie we're going to see, I don't know if you guys saw one of the trailers. One of the trailers, you have the religious coming together, and they're talking about when he gathered the people and he fed 5,000. And there's an incredible statement in that. It's in the movie, not in the scripture. And I thought, oh, wow, that's amazing. And it's too religious. I don't know who it was because it's just a trailer, so it just flashes up the statements made, and then it moves on. But he says, he fed 5,000. 5,000! You see what's going on here? There's this looking on, but there's these guys. They had, from their perspective, they had lost everything. Their power, their prosperity, their positions. The people by the droves, 5,000 at least, were following him. They lost everybody. They got to take every opportunity to win this back. We told you that he was a charlatan, that he was a liar, that he was a fake. We told you all that. You see, that's what they're doing here. But good grief, you think that that could wait until after the dude is dead? I mean, really? And notice here that the focus is all on him. We never read anything about the two murderers beside him. Murderers. Murderers, man. We don't read anything about those guys. No comments, nothing that they're getting what they deserve. One of them's going to say that. But of the people surrounding, I mean, there's so much happening here. Now notice, they stood looking on, but even the rulers, that's the religious, sneered at him. This word sneered is really powerful. And that's close. Sneered is close. But what it really means is to have a look of disdain and to upturn your face like this. Like Marie gives me sometimes if I don't eat my vegetables. No, I'm just kidding. It's a serious word, much more than just sneered. I mean, it was a sign of disgust. That's what they're doing here. That's what's taking place. And then, of course, the lame comment, he saved others, let him save himself. Well, they got it right in the first part. He saved others. Yes, he had. The word literally saved, so-so. It literally means to be delivered. He had delivered others. Yes, he did. Nobody could deny that. He set guys free from demonic oppression and possession. He had given speech back to those that couldn't speak. He had given sight back to those that couldn't see. He had given hearing back to those that couldn't hear. He'd given purity to those who were so decayed and destroyed by a disease called leprosy. Oh, he'd done all those things. No one could argue with that. He had even called a dead guy after 4 days and said, come out. And it had all happened. He saved others. They got the first part right. Let him save himself if he's the Christ. Whoa. Now notice what they're saying, what he did for these other people we just identified with what they're asking them. They're saying that he needs to come down from the cross. That's the proof they need. Geez, you would think somebody that can see now and hear and talk now and has clean skin and is no longer dead, you think that would have been enough, wouldn't you? I mean, if a person showed up doing those things today, by the way, they're out there. You're going to start hearing about them more and more. Pay attention. Because Jesus told us they were coming. They're going to do these wonderful things, and everybody's going to go, oh, he's the Christ. No, he's stinking not. He's not. I have to tell you again, as a pastor, I have to warn you. You're going to see this. There will be somebody, possibly more, but specifically one, who will raise the dead. He will. And he's going to do all of the things that Jesus did. Don't be fooled. Remember when we were in Matthew 24, Jesus said, this is going to happen. Don't be deceived, Jesus said. Because the logical thing is to say, because he's going to make the claim that I am the Christ. Jesus said, do not follow him. And tell me, if somebody came on the scene right now and we all heard about this, we would all be coming. I'd have you guys in the office at all hours saying, is this the Christ? Could he really be the Christ? And you know what my reply is going to be? Did you see him fly across the sky like lightning from one end to the other? No. Well, then he ain't the Christ. I don't care what he does. Impressive as it may be. As nice as it may be. Oh, he restored that child's life to him. Good, I'm glad he did that. But that doesn't make him the Messiah. Jesus said, don't follow them. For as lightning comes out of the east all the way into the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. I'm getting all riled up here, aren't I? If he didn't appear like lightning, he ain't the Christ. I don't care what he does. Period. I'm warning you. Don't buy it. The little tent revivals. There's books written about that. Read the, Peretti, I think, that wrote The Prophet? Read that. That's amazing. Because that's why I was reading that. I'm going, oh man, this is what's going to happen. And by the thousands, people came out of the fellowships because they said, because the pastors were warning them like I'm warning you. And they said, but that can't be right. Look at what he's doing. Look at the good things he's doing. The people are no longer starving in Ethiopia. The people are no longer, you know, dying of these diseases all over this world because of this man. He must be the Messiah. No, he's not. That's how the world will bow down before him. Do you want to be one of those? I don't care what he does. I don't care if he can walk this high off the dang ground. He's not Messiah. Jesus said, you'll know when I show up. There'll be no question. See? So, I have to warn you, because I'm telling you right now, some of you will buy into this. I'm telling you, as sad as that sounds, and it's heartbreaking to think that that's going to happen. He saved others. Let him save himself. If in fact he is the Christ, the Christos, for them Mashiach, if he is Messiah, the chosen one of God. If he really is, let him do all of these things. They had so blindly misunderstood that the scripture said that those very things, that he's on that cross, proved that he was the Messiah. And they had missed it. The religion had blinded their eyes. Now, Matthew breaks it up. Luke puts them all together, the religious as well as the crowd, the rulers with the crowd. So I want to take a look at these things real quick, and then I'm going to have to close here. Dang, I only got through three verses. Dang. Hey. Well, that's a reason to come back next week then, right? The crowd. Matthew chapter 27, this is, of course, the Matthew's account of the same thing. Mark's would be chapter 15, by the way, if you're wondering, 14 and 15. So here in Matthew, this is what Matthew says. And those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads, shaking their heads, just going, oh boy, oh boy. And this is what they were saying. You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Now, wasn't that interesting? His trial had just happened a few hours earlier. Remember that? Okay? Just a few hours ago. Before, right at sunrise, when the council was called together, after the night with Pilate, after the night with Herod, he would go back to Pilate. But after all of that, they brought him before the council, and they couldn't find anybody to agree until somebody showed up in that trial that said, well, I heard him say he's going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Now, of course, he was talking about his spiritual temple, not the physical temple. And that was one of the accusations that they used. But even that didn't hold water. They got him when he admitted that he was the Son of God. But isn't it interesting that in a closed court case that had just taken place, because we're still before 9 o'clock in the morning here, by the way, okay, from sun up, 6, the first hour, 6, third hour, 9, sixth hour, noon, ninth hour, 3. Because remember, they didn't have clocks, okay? They didn't tell time like you and I did. This is how they did it. So at first hour, they would have met in the council. Then all that stuff had happened. They'd have marched him through the streets to this point. How is it that the crowd knows what happened at that trial in a matter of a couple hours? How is that? Boy, word spreads like wildfire, doesn't it? I mean, we're talking just a very small 120 minutes, roughly, probably even less than that. And the crowds are now throwing back something that he was accused of in that trial. Now, some may have heard him say it when he made the statement. I'm sure that's a possibility too. But this is based on that statement, which is what the religious said put him up on the cross. It's absolutely amazing when you stop and think about this. And those who passed by, they blasphemed him. And blaspheme means to speak evil of. That's literally what it means. And wagging their heads, and they were saying, you could destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Well, that's exactly what he meant when he said that. They're going to destroy this temple, but in 3 days I will rebuild it. I will restore myself, just not on your time schedule. Right? Above all nations, above all things, right? Amazing. But look at the last statement. If you are the Son of God, and there it is again, come down from the cross. Now we look at this and we almost laugh. Because the fact was, he was on the cross because he was the Son of God. They had completely seen the other side of this. They completely missed it. That's the crowd. Well, then there was the council, the religious. Likewise, Matthew tells us, so now he's bringing the second group in, likewise the chief priests also. That is the Pharisees, the scribes, as well as the Sadducees. Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with the scribes and the elders, said, he saved others. Remember, delivered. He delivered others. Himself he cannot save. Again, sure he could have. But he didn't, because deliverance for those yo-yos had to take place, because he wouldn't deliver himself from the cross. He delivered others. Himself he cannot deliver or save. If he is the King of Israel, notice the ultimate thing that put him on the cross, we're going to see as we move forward in this, not today. If he is the King of Israel, then let him now come down from the cross. Now isn't, oh gosh, there's so much here. And we will believe him. I hate that last statement. I would like to think that if I was standing next there and they made that statement, I'd look at them and just smack them. Because that just irritates me. Really. Oh, if all these things happen, then we'll believe him. See, no, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't. Well, that's real brave Rick, right? Yeah, sounds really good, doesn't it? Yeah, you know, got to walk out of here and send you guys to lunch thinking, man, that Rick would have really took a stand. No, he wouldn't. He would have weenied out. He would have noodled out. Dang, and that's on video. Crud. Let him now come down from the cross and we will believe him if he's the King of Israel. Now, what's interesting about this? If he's the King of Israel. Now, think about this. If you're a Jew and you say, well, if he's the King of Israel, what King of Israel would have been able to come off a cross? Think about that. If this had been David, would David have been able to come off the cross? No. If it had been Solomon, could he? No. Hezekiah? No. Zephaniah? No. We can go on and on. This is just a dumb thing to say. No king in Israel could come off the cross, which they were accusing him of. And it's amazing that some of the people standing by just go, what are you talking about? Nobody could come off that thing. But you see, it was stirring up the crowds. And then, of course, they add, oh, he trusted in God. Let him deliver him now, if he will have him. For he said, I am the Son of God. Now, I don't know about you, but immediately what my mind goes to is a fellow by the name of Abraham, who had a son named Isaac. Now, if you're a Jew, that's a pretty big thing. Abraham could have delivered his son, not put him on the altar, but he did. How they didn't get this is absolutely beyond me. Just beyond those that claim to know and understand. And then the last group, the condemned. Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him at the same thing. Now, one of those guys is going to have a change of heart as he's viewing all the stuff that's going to happen from this point on. Okay? That's what's going on. Yeah. They reviled the same thing. They were spitting jeers at him. And by the way, that word reviled, it doesn't mean they were just talking smack. It means they were trashing him with their words. Cursing, doing everything that you would imagine a person to do in these things. Crud, I hit my thumb with a hammer and things flow out of here that, well, we'll just leave that at that. Okay? So don't tell me that what's going on here. And that's the point at which we were at. Now, we're going to have to stop there because there's a lot more to go. A lot. But again, step by step.